The demographic bulge of this boomer phenomenon is not unique to Canada. It's happened in Western Europe and the United States. And there's ample research that shows every stage of this generation's life in the United States, in Britain, in Europe, in Canada, we've underestimated the impact that they're going to have. So there were diaper shortages when boomers were first born. Then there weren't enough classrooms when they started going into schools. There weren't enough homes even built when they moved into the housing market and were looking for shelter and a house. And now we know that there's very few countries prepared for both the healthcare and the long-term care requirements of this generation. And so the lessons we're learning in Ontario, I think, are applicable everywhere.
This is Coming of Age, Meeting the Needs of Our Aging Population, a podcast about how we can better support our seniors. I'm your host, Donna Duncan. I am also the CEO of the Ontario Long-Term Care Association, which represents about 70% of long-term care homes in Ontario, Canada. This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Point Click Care. Welcome back to a new episode of Coming of Age. In 4 years, the oldest of the baby boom generation will turn 80. By 2040, Ontario's population over 80 will have doubled. For many people, the impact of these statistics is hard to envision. However, as boomers soon get older and start developing complex care needs, the services and supports we provide will also need to expand. Until recently, however, one of the missing pieces of information in our conversations about future seniors care planning was how well the baby boom generation is preparing itself for potential challenges as it ages. As the oldest of the boomers approaches 80, we wanted to know, how are they preparing for the next stage of their lives? What do they think about their future care needs? And what plans are they putting in place to meet those needs? In today's episode, I'm chatting with David Coletto, CEO of one of Canada's leading polling and public opinion research firms, Abacus Data. With a career spanning over two decades, David has devoted his life to exploring what people think and feel about their work and lives. In May 2023, the Ontario Long-Term Care Association commissioned Abacus Data to survey 1,000 Ontario residents aged 68 to 76 to help us with our policy planning for the future. In our wide-ranging discussion, David and I explore what we learn from the research and the implications of those findings for families, governments, and seniors care providers. Let's dive in. So, David, welcome to our podcast. I'm so delighted to have you join us this morning and to share some insights on some research that you and your team at Abacus have done on behalf of the Ontario Long-Term Care Association. I think it speaks not only for what boomers need to prepare for, but what their children and decision makers and policymakers need to think about. I'm wondering if you could share with us what you see as the three biggest takeaways from our survey with you on boomers.
Yeah, good to be here, Donna, and thanks for the invitation. Look, so this survey, as you said, we interviewed 1,000 Ontario residents aged 68 to 76. And I think the big takeaways are, one, almost most, if not close to all, boomers in the province are not really thinking about plans for aging or what's going to happen to them as they age. There is a subset who are thinking a lot about it, but the vast majority say, I'm thinking only a little or I haven't thought at all about this. So that's the first takeaway. Two is that I think people's expectations about what kind of care they might need, what the costs are, how easy it might be to retrofit their home or pay for ongoing care, I think is quite low. So given that people aren't thinking about it, they also, because they haven't thought about it, perhaps aren't as realistic as they should be about what the potential cost is there. And then finally is one area where most boomers in the province agree is that the province is not ready for the demographic tsunami that is the boomers aging. And I think that points to a contradiction in that you're not thinking about it, you're not preparing yourself, but then you also don't think the system's ready for you. And I think that's a big wake-up call from this research.
It's such an interesting point in that, again, we've all had this myopia and not want to think about aging. So here we have one of the largest, most influential demographic groups in, if not the most influential demographic group in the history of the world, has informed every major policy decision.
Yeah, the demographic bulge of this boomer phenomenon is not unique to Canada. It's happened in Western Europe, in the United States. And there's ample research that shows every stage of this generation's life in the United States, in Britain, in Europe, in Canada, we've underestimated the impact that they're going to have. So there were diaper shortages when boomers were first born. Then there weren't enough classrooms when they started going into schools. There weren't enough homes even built when they moved into the housing market and were looking for shelter and a house. And now we know that there's very few countries prepared for both the healthcare and the long-term care requirements of this generation. And so the lessons we're learning in Ontario, I think, are applicable everywhere. I suspect if we replicated this survey in any state in the US, in the UK, you'd find very similar results because it's human nature to not want to think about the inevitable, right? An extended period of aging. And I think people understand they're going to likely live longer on average, but they don't really want to think through or have conversations about what that's going to mean. I think this data shows that as a society, as a whole, regardless of what generation you're from, my parents are boomers. I'm a geriatric millennial, as some have called me in my early 40s. I'm starting to think about this and recognizing that now's the best time to plan for my parents' care, not when the immediate need is there.
The pandemic was devastating for older people, and yet what it did was shine a light on the fact that the infrastructure that was in place to support our aging demographic, not only in Ontario, but across Canada, the United States, and around the world, was stuck in the 1960s. And our care models hadn't evolved, governments hadn't invested. But nor had we as voters. We've had so many individuals on the podcast who've been talking about ageism, a reluctance to talk about aging, a reluctance to talk about consequential chronic disease that might accompany aging or any loss of control. And so therefore, let's just not talk about it. As you think about some of the other trends and research that you've done, what else do we need to be thinking about? What are some of the other conversations we've not been having that influence?
Well, look, I think there is a story around Canada, like many countries, is in the midst of a housing crisis. You've got intergenerational angst, I would call it, between those that own a home today and those that want to own a home. I think this is part of the housing question that sometimes often viewed separate. I mean, that's the problem often with public policy debates, is that we get into the silos of this is long-term care, this is healthcare, this is education, this is housing, this is social care, and yet they're all related, right? I look at this as being part housing and dealing with the housing question. To your point about people living through the pandemic, seeing the inadequacy, the unpreparedness of the system as a whole. And it's not to point fingers at any one provider or government, just the simple fact that, like in a lot of things that the pandemic reminded us as, we were not prepared for it in any real way, decided we're not going to want to deal with it right now. I think at the end of the day, as more and more people begin to recognize that in the next 14 years, StatsCan estimates, in Canada anyways, the number of those over the age of 85 is going to double.
If we think about in Ontario, the government's committed to adding almost 30,000 new long-term care spaces. That's a minimum of 30,000 new care workers to support our long-term care homes alone, just the, not factoring for any kind of attrition. And I want to give Ontario credit. So Ontario's committed billions in funding for capital renewal to deal with those old homes with the ward rooms that we know were a root cause of the spread of the disease, especially in that first year. They've reduced occupancy in those rooms that are still there. They've invested billions in a commitment to 4 hours of care on an average across the province. They've provided funding for preceptors in long-term care. They've provided funding for training for medical directors. They've provided dedicated funding for nurse practitioners, for registered social workers. We have had more long-term care homes rebuilt and built in Ontario over the last 2 years than we have in the last 20. Of those people over the age of 85, 10 to 20% of them will, whether or not they like it, have an unplanned chronic or critical illness that will require them to get more specialized care. This is sort of this, so what? How can we make this wake-up call?
I think the first step is problem recognition. And I don't think enough people know just how significant the demographic shift is. When I say doubling of the number of 85-year-olds to audiences or to people, they're surprised. They don't know this, right? So this is the first step, is the fact, is just simple facts. Our population is aging. More and more people are going to need some care at some point in their life, as you said, Donna. It's recognizing that there's a big problem, that it can't be solved in a short period of time, and we have to invest now. And I think that story is one that will find a lot of support if it's communicated. There's no doubt in my mind. I ask thousands of people questions every week that they see the inability of our healthcare system broadly being inadequate, even for our needs today. So I think there is a huge opportunity for political leadership to take this issue, to own it, frankly, and to be seen as thoughtful and preparing. And so, although the provincial government in Ontario maybe hasn't gotten all the credit yet it deserves for its leadership on this, I think it can if it chooses to. And it will be able to say the moment that that wave starts to happen that we were preparing, we were doing the work that needs to be done.
To your point, the scope and scale of it's pretty huge. One thing I want to go back to that you touched on a bit, David, I've been on a number of panels and have been challenged by some younger people in the audience about that housing point and the have and have nots and this divide between generations, where I was challenged to say why I can't afford a house. Why should we be putting all of our money and resources and time into this older demographic who had it all? And what about me? I'm wondering if you could reflect on us now, where we're so super segmented on cultural group, demographic groups, age, population, geography, and lost that sense of this is our collective challenge to solve.
With that mindset that you described, that me versus them, what some have described as zero-sum thinking, right? And there was an interesting study that came out of Harvard that showed the relationship between the socioeconomic, economic, macroeconomic factors around when somebody was raised and their tendency to think in zero-sum terms. And zero-sum versus positive sum is zero-sum is there's a scarce amount of resources and we're all fighting over it. And if I get it, somebody else doesn't, or if somebody else gets it, I don't. Positive sum is if the tide rises, all boats will be lifted. I think you're seeing among particularly younger generations today, this zero-sum thinking becoming more prevalent because they do feel that there's limited access to certain resources. And so I suspect we're going to see more and more of that as we go forward. And so the question is, if you're trying to build political support for investment in those who are aging, policymakers are also going to have to be aware that they have to be able to say we're also investing in making sure that younger generations have access to the education that they have, they need, the housing that they need, and the economic opportunities that older generations have. It's the coming challenge that we're going to face, particularly in countries that have these big generations, these boomers and these millennials fighting it out. Even if millennials are the kids of boomers, this intergenerational clash, I think, is something that's going to be much more real and politically powerful.
how does this influence retirements, the dispersal of wealth? We know that retrofitting a home or having to pay for private care can be devastating in terms of the cost. And so any expectation for this next generation to benefit from any wealth that their parents have may be diminished. I know you've done some work around pension planning and retirement planning. Do you have a sense around what the potential impacts will be between the baby boomers and their preparedness to fund a longer retirement, which may require more specialized care, including in home, and then their kids' expectation around what they might inherit?
Yeah, every year we do this study with the Ontario Healthcare Pension Plan, which is a pension plan that covers healthcare workers in Ontario. And we look at retirement security and how prepared people are and what they think about retirement. And what's always shocking to me is in Ontario, and I suspect this is true across the country, in Canada, 1 in 4 of those 60 and overs have zero money saved up. 1 in 4, $0 saved, right? And so how do they prepare if they're going to be asked to pay for some of their own care, whether it's to retrofit their home or, you know, cover the cost of any private care that they might need going forward? So there's a lot of older Canadians who aren't prepared, who don't have any savings at all. That's the first point. The second is there is a perception that for those boomers who have had a good career, were able to save money, made a lot of money off the value of their homes going up in almost every community across the country, that their kids are waiting in a way for some of that inheritance to help them. But I hear my parents talk about it. They're in their late 60s. They're well off. I'm not going to say they should struggle at all, but they are still unsure about how much it's going to cost and how long they're going to live. And I think that's going to play a big part in the relationship between families, the relationship between generations more broadly, and the idea that we're going to see, like we see in the housing market, if you own a home, it is the biggest predictor of your wealth over your life than if you don't. I think it's going to be a huge part of the disparity between someone's care as they age. And we see it in the survey work we did with you, Donna, that those who are living in households with lower income are far more likely to say, I don't think it's realistic for me to stay at home. I'm not going to be able to afford to make any changes to my house. I won't be able to afford for any care. And that's a sizable group of the population. And so again, policymakers, planners, anyone looking at this data is going to be able to say, we've got to start preparing now for the inevitable, or we're going to face real tragedy as people need care and aren't going to be able to find it. The other thing that's different, we know it, is families don't live as close to each other as they used to. We know there's still a flight away from small and rural communities. I live in Ottawa. My family lives around Toronto. Thankfully, I have a sister who lives close to my parents because 5-hour drive is far. I think those dynamics have also changed. That means boomers may also be much more likely to be alone than older generations. So there's a lot of dynamics at work that I think are going to complicate this. But what's clear is I don't think enough people of any generation have given enough thought of this, and they aren't willing to talk about it, which is so interesting. Because in our survey, at one hand, boomers say, I have no problem talking about this. But on the other hand, they say, but there's a stigma talking about aging, which tells me that they're probably not comfortable talking about it. And that means they probably don't want to have this conversation with their kids that often.
Well, to that point, and one of the questions we asked, we really related to who would consider turning to family and friends for support to remain at home. And only 20% in our survey indicated that they would consider turning to family and friends for support to remain at home, which means that they actually haven't had that discussion and are reluctant to ask for help. There seems to be this expectation that it will be the family caregivers who will step up and help.
Well, it's not to say that the family won't step up. We don't know that, actually. It's that the boomers who will need that support aren't convinced or confident that their family will. that might be part reality. They might know that I won't be able to rely on my kids or family members or whoever. I think a recognition that they just don't know and they can't guarantee it, which if you think of the psychology of that is going to have a big impact on the choices those people are going to make, right? Whether they're because their family live farther away, whether they don't think they want to be a burden on their family, whether like it's culturally, it's always different. And even within Canada, you're going to find differences across different cultural groups. But at the end of the day, most Ontarians, boomers say, I don't think I'm going to be able to rely on them and I'm not planning on it happening. And so I think that's a big part of this, that the system can't assume that there's going to be that support network around people. And as time goes on, the other thing to keep in mind, if we look long term, is we're having fewer and fewer kids. Families are much smaller than they used to be. There's fewer people who can be there to care for an aging parent. Think of me. I'm 40, so hopefully I won't need any care in 40 plus years, but I have no children. Who's going to care? You know, so we have generations who aren't going to have any kids. So all of this is changing, I think, the way, and we have to be thinking about how the system's going to support all of these different life choices that people have made along the way.
Well, and to your earlier point about kids leaving the communities where their parents grew up, we've certainly been hearing from municipal leaders in Ontario that one of the phenomena that they've been trying to cope with is older people have actually moved out of urban centers and have moved to smaller communities. They've left without their doctor and they've left without their families. And so the smaller, more rural communities are suddenly realizing that they've got a problem or an opportunity, actually. And we are starting to see some real creativity with the leadership of some of these mayors to step up and start say, oh my goodness, we have to think differently. We are also seeing municipal leaders who are saying our senior strategy is all about aging in place and we're going to make it possible to for everybody to age at home. And with that expectation that family and friends will step up. So is the key right now is to start to ask the question, will you look after me?
Yeah, I think it's important to have that conversation now, right? And not to be afraid of it. I know plenty of people, and we've done research on this too, in their 60s who don't have wills in place, haven't had the conversations about what happens if something happens to me or if I get an illness. It's this short-term thinking, which is completely natural, by the way, but we have this opportunity to be prepared. Younger generations have a responsibility, to take care of those who came before us, but those who are about to need the care also have a responsibility to be prepared and to be thinking about it. This whole NIMBY instinct is, we see it in housing, we see it in a lot of different areas. I think they're living in a fantasy land if they think that every single person who's going to need care. And I remind the listeners, at least in the Canadian context, doubling of the number of 85 plus year olds in the next 15 years, doubling, even if a small percentage of them need care in a home, in a facility outside of their own home, we're going to need way more than we have now. Like it's just simple math. It's so obvious to me. And our system in Ontario, in Canada, like in other federations, you've got three levels of government. Coordination across them is not always easy. This is going to be one of those crises or problems that, like the housing crisis is today, that 20 years ago we said, it's obvious, the demographics are going to be here. 20 years from now, Donna, I hope we don't listen back to this podcast and say, we knew this was coming and we weren't prepared. And now we're facing the consequences in significant real ways.
We do see this as housing. So in long-term care, the way it's structured is, individuals who move into long-term care have almost rent geared to income. So there is a copay for their accommodation. Then the government covers all of the cost of their care. And it's housing. And yet local governments are recognizing this, that in most cases, again, lots of creativity in smaller communities. That's where we're seeing movement, where we're seeing new homes being built for long-term care homes. That's where we're seeing more creativity and local problem solving. I think some of our biggest issues are actually going to be in our urban centers. And how do we mobilize individuals to problem solve, but bring the right decision makers to the table You've seen the trends on saving for aging, and you've seen the trends on conversation about aging and dying over the years. And while we're making some progress, how do we change those conversations? There doesn't seem to be any sense of urgency.
There's so many issues where you could point to that there is no sense of urgency, and which is, I think, one of the reasons why when I ask people how they feel about their governments or certain political leaders, there's a lot of unhappiness right now because there are so many issues, climate change, housing, healthcare, long-term care, that on all of those, there's majorities of people across Canada, and I suspect in every country around the world, that is grappling with these issues saying, why aren't we moving faster? I think part of it is exhaustion coming out of the pandemic. If you were somebody leading during that period, you're probably really tired and it's hard to now focus on a long-term vision. I think our politics naturally doesn't, as we said earlier, doesn't work well at that. But I do think there is a real, you know, if I'm going to make this a real political opportunity to say how you're going to fund it, to say who's going to be part of the decisions and building, but the vision is on the other end of it. I think it's completely possible. So you cite what's happening in Ontario. It's really heartening for me to hear because it's so hard to get information about what's happening in government these days. We don't all watch the same news. We don't all consume the same media. So it's very hard for governments to communicate. I think it's still really important that they do and try to engage and show the progress that's being made. I think the public is more flexible and lenient than we give it credit for, but it just wants to see action. So I think there's a lot of political upside for anybody who wants to see this problem on, who brings the public on to recognizing there's a big challenge ahead of us. But we have the time, we still have time, and we have the means to solve it. And whether it's the private sector with the public sector and the not-for-profit sector working together, I think our polling and others finds common ground in wanting to see all three of those sectors work together in long-term care to solve that problem.
Well, and one of the points of hope, certainly from my lens in reviewing your data, is that the people who've had some sort of direct experience with long-term care actually reflect more positively on that experience. Is there more work to do? Absolutely. I believe that there is far more work going on today than others, than anybody actually knows about, to your point. A lot of innovation with partnerships with hospitals, with primary care, partnerships with mental health organizations on the front line, partnerships in clusters of long-term care homes, partnerships with other municipal and community services, and partnerships with families and residents like we've never had before. Today's long-term care is not the long-term care of 2020 in Ontario, Canada.
My mom, if she listens to this podcast, will hate that I talk about her too much. She's one of those folks, Donna, you mentioned earlier, who's had direct relationships in the system. She's got my grandmother in long-term care. She goes to that home twice a week, three times a week, every week, and sees firsthand how challenging it is, but also how hard people work just to try to care for my grandmother. I think people who have direct interaction with the system are going to be the most strongest advocates for investment in it because they know what's needed and what's possible. And so they are more positive than those who don't have direct interactions. And I think will be a very powerful force for change as they prepare for themselves to need that care at some point in the next 20, 30 years of their life.
Well, and apologies to David's mother, but imagine your mom wants autonomy, but also wants to have the assurance that should she ever need support and service, that whatever that support and service may be, that it's available, whether that's in home or community or hospital, primary care, or more specialized long-term care. We need people to understand what's happening in their local community and to move from the ground up and bring people into long-term care homes, to let them take some ownership and accountability for ensuring the supports are there in their community could have more success.
Yeah, I mean, look at the lesson, I think, in how much ownership people feels of over a local hospital, right? Particularly in a small community, that local hospital is, for many, a signal of the lifeblood of that community. If it closes because they don't have enough physicians and you can't get emergency care, it is devastating to the psyche of that community, and any change to it is highly defensive. Why can't the same affection be felt towards a long-term care facility? Maybe it is. In smaller communities, it is. It is seen as that. But in a large, in suburban Toronto or suburban Ottawa or Vancouver or wherever, that's maybe less likely to be the case, but it doesn't need to be that way, right? Because I think we have to start to change people's perception that these homes, they are homes, whether they are privately owned and run, whether they're a public facility, whether they're nonprofit, are assets to the community. They are not things we should not want built. They are things we absolutely want more of them, and to integrate them into the community. I think it will be an important shift in our conversation. For so long, we've viewed a long-term care home as a place we definitely don't want to go ourselves, that it's kind of the last resort of care that we need, as opposed to being a place that is valued and is seen as essential to the health of a community. I think we're going to get there. We're seeing a change in views around aging. I think there's a much more holistic, open mind to it, but it's going to still take a leadership. And that's leadership in the community and leadership within the sectors as well. But I see evidence of it. And I think it's coming.
I do too. I like that hopeful note, David. I look forward to the next iteration of this study. Thanks for your leadership and for fostering the conversation that we need to have.
Well, you're welcome, Donna. I think this study is so important. It's going to spark that conversation. It was great to chat with you. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to Coming of Age, the podcast that is changing the conversation on seniors' care and aging. We hope this episode brings a new perspective and inspires you to continue the conversation with your colleagues, friends, and family. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so that more listeners will join our community of changemakers in seniors care. Until next time, I'm your host, Donna Duncan. Keep well. This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Point Click Care. Point Click Care is a leading healthcare technology platform enabling meaningful collaboration and access to real-time insights at any stage of a patient's healthcare journey. PointClick Care's single platform spans the care continuum, fostering proactive, holistic decision-making and improved outcomes for all. Over 25,000 long-term post-acute care providers and more than 1,600 hospitals use PointClick Care today. For more information on PointClick Care's software solutions, visit pointclickcare.com.